This is the Diddly Dumb Podcast. The following episode is based on actual opinions. It is important to remember, however, that you can't retcon Doctor Who. Not one line. Except perhaps when you represent the empty space that circles time. Day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 151 of the Diddly Dumb Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And what's been happening since last we gathered? Anything interesting?
On Saturday, one of my friends alerted me to a film that was showing on Film 4. It was Sinbad and the Golden Voyage, which stars the lovely Caroline Munro, and also Tom Baker. I haven't seen it for decades, and it was an absolute treat.
I watched that at the weekend.
Oh, you did?
No, but not as it was on Channel 4. I just came across it on Netflix or something.
Oh. I enjoyed the appearance by the extras from Kroll on it.
Yeah,
it's very enjoyable watching Tom ham it up as a baddie for once.
Well, you're watching that, aren't you, knowing that that Barry Letts was in the cinema?
Yeah.
Across from the BBC watching that, and that's what made him think, oh, that's... I'm thinking all along, what is he seeing in here then that he's making him think, oh, he'll be good? Because he's not doctorish at all in it, is it? He's a baddie.
No.
Unless it's just his voice and his presence.
He does kind of regenerate. Towards the end, maybe.
Yes, that's true.
So I always got that nailed. it was funny, actually, because I'm in a WhatsApp group with a few of my friends, and a couple of them were watching it as well. So I had a chance to nerd out at them and say, do you realise that the makers of Doctor Who went to see this film to see if Tom would be suitable as their leading man for Doctor Who? And they decided on watching this that he was, which didn't get the applause that it deserved. So I sent them a picture of Tom standing there carrying a hod with all his workmates from his labouring days that he did in between the film and getting the job as Doctor Who. And that went down an absolute storm. That was news to them and they very much enjoyed the photos. So that was a success.
Have you still got the white suit, Tom?
I've still got the Kango.
It's great what you say, Mark, about nerding out to the non-wee when you're watching films. Because sometimes when I'm sitting there watching Star Wars with people, I go, do you know, this is... At some point at the cinema, Tom Baker and Graham Williams went and saw this and said to each other, we're f***ed.
And they go, who? And you say, that's right, Doctor.
Exactly, that's the
one.
I also watched The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, which is the one with the magic lamp in it. And I certainly think that Golden Voyage is much better.
I've never seen it. I've never seen either of them.
Oh, they're just a lovely... I know I watched it on Saturday afternoon, but it's a lovely sort of Sunday afternoon vibe to them. I used to watch them quite a lot as a kid. In fact, I had the novelisation of The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, I believe.
Was it written by Terence Dix?
Yeah, it is written that the fountain of destiny lies within easy march. Yes, where the gods smile upon mortal men. But I shall not enter that hallowed place empty-handed, for it is also written that he who places each of these tablets into the waters of the fountain shall receive in turn youth, a shield of darkness, and best of all, a crown of untold riches. All this is my destiny.
I could really do with us locating the Fountain of Destiny. Because you may not realise this, faithless listeners, but every time we record a podcast, our bodies get a little bit older. We suddenly realise that one of our hands has become covered in wrinkles or something like that. Ray Harryhausen was, of course, one of the Rev's heroes.
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
He was your hero, was he, Rev?
He was one of my heroes, yeah.
Do you want to really hate me?
Go on.
He was in, sometime in the 70s, he was in Manchester. He came to our school to give us a tour.
Did he?
Oh, wow.
And I had no idea who he was. I don't know if I knew who he was you did the show, what sort of things he was doing. But I thought that he was called Mr. Housen, and that Harry must have been his middle name. I thought, are you calling Mr. Ray Harryhausen?
Yeah.
That's strange. But what was really weird, he had two guys with him.
Uh-huh.
Who were quite clearly packing heat under their jackets.
Wow.
So quite clearly had guns with them. That's strange. Like, you wouldn't think... Well, an animator would, mind you, maybe they'd heard about Manchester.
Well, who knows? I mean, some of his UFO animations and things could well have been based on actual American government files, for all we know. Perhaps he was wanted by the FBI.
Speaking of hands, my friend has an old Doctor Who book around his house that a friend lent me, and I dropped it back around there, and it's been sat on his shelf for the last year. And his mum went round there the other day, and she picked it up and started flicking through it. And she used to work in the makeup department in television. She used to work for TVS and Meridian, but before that she worked for the BBC as a junior. And yeah. She was looking through and she's going, oh, I recognise a lot of these names from the makeup department in the credits for these. I said, oh, yes, I knew a lot of these. I said, I only ever worked on one episode of Doctor Who. I can't remember which one it was, but all I had to do was to glue pieces of fur to some rubber gloves. And she couldn't remember what it was. So I suspect my friend's mum may well have worked on Inferno.
Oh.
Oh, I was going to say Plans of Evil.
Oh.
You know where Sorensen, what's he called? Freddy Jaeger.
Well, it's just the fact that it seemed to be multiple. I would have thought it was quite a crappy job that had been farmed out to a junior. So I got the impression from what my friend said that she had to do quite a lot of it.
Oh, okay.
So that was quite exciting to find out. I shall no doubt harass her more about it next time I bump into her.
Yeah, I thought you had to ask her what sort of year it's likely to have been, because you've got Sorensen in Planets of Evil. He turns into a sort of Primord, doesn't he? And then they got...
It would have been early 70s, I think, so
yeah.
which doesn't rule out either of our choices.
No, but it's
really.
It's Inferno. Gosh.
Oh, well, no, so I think it probably is Inferno.
Did you say, and also, when I wasn't doing that, I was having to jump off gas towers?
It's funny, because all these years I've known her, and I think she knows that I do a Doctor Who podcast, and she's never mentioned it. So, yeah, 5 years that I've been doing this podcast, and she's never mentioned it.
I had a friend at school, actually still quite good friends with him now, and his aunt was one of the puppeteers on Spitting Image, and she did the Genesis Land of Confusion video, which I used to find terrifying as a kid, but somehow didn't include in my things that scared me. Like the You're Never Alone with a Swan and Ghost Town by the Specials. I actually saw that advert the other day. It was on a programme. And to give myself some credit, even though it's Strand Cigarette, he's holding a swan filter tip box when he's lighting the cigarette. So it does say swan there. And also, considering the fact that I was recently diagnosed as being hard of hearing, it really wouldn't surprise me, as even 20 years ago that was the issue.
Oh, God, I wonder why that made me remember. Land of Confusion, when I was at university, was what was being played in the students' union that everyone should dance to. 1986, bloody hell.
Diddly-dum. Did you have Trial of the Time Lord on in the corner of the room at the time?
No, hardly. I think it was that. Last Christmas, I think a lot of them were playing, what do they call them? Where they came from? Hull.
Oh,
House Martins.
House Martins, yeah.
The House Martins. What a good place
to be. Happy Hour Again.
Happy Hour Again, yeah.
What a year.
How did we get onto that? Oh, yes, a friend of the show, Simon Brett, not so long ago, tweeted a request for people to name their two favourite albums from the year that they turned 13, didn't he?
Yeah.
We had a long... What you two decided?
I went for By the Way by Red Hot Chili Peppers and Original Pirate Material by The Streets.
I can't remember now, but I think I'd probably go for Prince, Purple Rain, and This Is Spinal Tap.
I think I went for Bill Haley and his Comets.
And Akabilk.
No, it was... I think I went for Unknown Pleasures by Joy Division, and...
You say London Calling was the other
London one? London Calling by The Clash. It was a stretch to whether I was going to go for The Clash or The Buzzcocks, but... Although I preferred The Buzzcocks, The Clash, that's a particular Clash album, had the better songs on it. What were we discussing this for? We started recording some like DVDs, was it?
Yeah, so basically there's... Zavi have sent out, when we're talking, ladies and gentlemen, Zavi today sent out copies of The Web of Fear a week early to some very lucky recipients.
Ooh.
And Matthew Purchase, who's a brilliant person to follow on Twitter, I think he's at Cyberdevil on Twitter, has been going through the DVD and sort of letting everyone know what he thinks. And he said that apparently the animation for episode 3 isn't as bad, this is obviously his opinion, isn't as bad as what everyone thinks or has said so far. And apparently the reconstruction, Telesnap reconstruction, is on disc 2 along with a load of extras, including, and I didn't realise this was going on here, but the Missing Years documentary that was included on the Lost in Time DVD, and also the Ice Warriors VHS box set from the late 90s.
Yeah, I think people only had about 30 seconds of footage of the animation to judge, didn't they? But that didn't stop anyone, did it?
No, I think the fact that people started comparing the faces to, you know, to me they looked a bit like GoldenEye N64. You know, were very flat and very angular and didn't really resemble the actors at all, really. Which is seems to be a common theme with the animation. How no one can kind of get the actors' likeness is beyond me for some people. Yeah, but I'm willing, obviously, to give it a go. I'm just considering it's The Web of Fear. My jamminess hasn't really come round just yet. The fact that I've been checking and HMV hasn't sent theirs out early. Keep refreshing my emails thinking, come on. People have got them out there. But it's interesting. And also, the Season 24 Blu-ray hasn't sold out online. You know how normally the limited edition box sets go by the time that they're pre-ordered up and that's it. Argos are currently selling it for £35 instead of £44.99 or whatever it was, £45, I think. And Amazon still have lots of copies going too. And I wondered whether it's for two reasons this. One is because it's not a very popular season. And secondly, because Amazon messed up a lot of people's pre-orders in the past, in the very recent past, with things like Season 8 and Season 14. Maybe people just haven't gone through Amazon this time and they've got a load of copies sitting there waiting. So if any listeners are still after Season 24, it's still out there. But it did make me wonder whether these new slipcase versions that myself and Doc have been buying might have also curtailed the want for the limited edition. I don't know. But yeah, what do you think, chaps? Do you think that the slipcases have come along and maybe curtailed the sales? Or do you think it's just because of pandemic problems with shipping and what have you, and Brexit laws coming in as well? Maybe that's hurt distribution? Because I know it has for other things.
Yeah, distribution on lots of things is absolutely screwed at the moment, isn't it? It took me... I ordered a present, admittedly from Germany, T-shirt for my daughter for her birthday on the 3rd of July. And it only just arrived today.
Oh, God.
because they'd had shipping problems, which was pretty annoying. Yeah, probably that. It wouldn't surprise me if the slipcases have damaged sales somewhat, because I think a lot of people would rather have those. And now that there's not the sort of rush, oh, this could be the only time we ever get to see it.
Yeah.
That's gone now.
But if that's true, then why would Xavi be able to supply all these rubber fears early?
I don't know, actually. Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe different distributor, perhaps. I'm not sure.
So what's different about this Web of Fear DVD?
They've restored the surviving episodes, and you've got the animated missing episode 2. Episode 3, even.
Did they not restore them for the DVD that went out shortly after it was...
They did, but I think they took extra care in restoring... I don't think they were restoring to HD standard. Technical and boring. But anyway, I don't think they restored to HD standard with either of them. That's why when the Enemy of the World Special Edition came out a couple of years ago, that wasn't the vanilla release like we had just after The Findings. It had an awful lot of like new features on there. But also they had gone back and restored once again the black and white film.
Well, screw that, I'm not buying another DVD.
Well, I don't have it anymore. I don't have The Web of Fear anymore, so this is one for me. And I am going to keep buying the Blu-rays and supporting the Blu-rays because I like these versions. Oh, I actually watched Spearhead from Space, the Blu-ray of that the other day, and thought it looked outstanding.
Have you ordered the Steelbook again? Is there a Steelbook?
Yeah, I haven't ordered any of the Steelbooks, actually. The only ones I have got are the Matt Smith Series 6, Series 7, and the 50th Anniversary Specials, because I didn't have them originally. They were on DVD. They were missing from my Blu-ray collection. No, the reason being is because I know for a fact that when the collections start coming out, we'll be buying these again. So I'm just buying them at the cheapest but best format I can find for now. And I just didn't... I thought with the Steelbooks, I thought, well, they'll just be going anyway. Also, furthermore, they released Power of the Daleks twice in 2 years as 5 years as a thing, and I'm now, I say lumbered with a Steelbook, actually, it fetches quite a lot of money on eBay now. But that Steelbook copy of Power of the Daleks is a bit of an oddity now against the rest of them, so I haven't been lured towards them, really.
Anything else of interest?
I've finished the Target storybook anthology.
Alright.
It was alright. Some stories are better than others, but you're always going to get that. There's 15 short stories in there. Starts off with Jodie Whittaker, Jodie Whittaker's Dr. Joy Wilkinson story, and then goes through. The Terence Dix short story is wonderful, and I quite enjoyed the one that replaced Gareth Roberts when he was cancelled by Doctor Who.
James Goss?
No, I've forgotten her name now. No, there's a female author.
Fufu Lamar.
That's it, yeah. She took over the Fourth Doctor story with Romana, and that's set between Sharda and the Five Doctors, which was very interesting.
I should have said RuPaul.
And Matthew Waterhouse's story is interesting in the fact that it's a Adric mini-adventure with Nyssa that takes place during the Visitation, where they go down to the Deep South. And there's a bit of a Huckleberry Finn vibe to it. Also a bit of a White Saviour vibe as well, which... I didn't get until I listened to Trap One. So, hi guys. There's your shout out. Colin Baker's one's not bad. Very much. You can feel his Doctor in that one. But it's the more modern day Doctor short stories which I think are a bit of a disappointment and let the book down. The Tenth Doctor story, which is written by Jenny Colgan, it includes the Metacrisis Doctor and Rose on the alternate Earth. And it just didn't like it at all, really. Just didn't enjoy it. Because it was about that version of the Doctor not really having the capabilities of the Doctor. So it was a bit rubbish, apart from till towards the end, I guess. And then the 11th Doctor story is a bit of an oddity. It's a data bank in the TARDIS that keeps refreshing itself. But it just doesn't quite hold together as a short story. It's an interesting concept. But all it is really is it's like reads like a computer readout all the way through. And it's like the computer's talking to itself. And it was, I didn't really get that one either. The Capaldi one wasn't too bad. The Dr. Nardole Bill taking Missy out to a gig in Seattle in 1991. To San Francisco, sorry. And the Dr. crowd surfs and knocks himself out. And he's in the same hospital as the one that He goes to as the seventh Doctor and leaves being the eighth Doctor, basically. So that one wasn't too bad. But yeah, I think 3 out of 5. The better stuff, I mean, like the third Doctor story is a precursor to Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
Ooh.
Which I actually, and that was Matthew Sweet wrote that one. That was probably the best. That probably was the best one. So, yeah, seek it out if you can.
This weekend on, by the way, it was the Return to Devil's End thing, the Weekend at Devil's End, run by Who's at the Playhouse, which we went to a couple of years ago, didn't we, the first one, where they had Damaris Hayman, John Levine, Richard Franklin and Katie Manning. And that was a wonderful weekend. It was only the afternoon, wasn't it, really? But it was seemed to cram a lot in, although we had been to a Blake 7 convention in the morning, so it felt like quite a long day. They had another one of those this weekend. It went over the 2 days, and they had Katie Manning, Richard Franklin and John Levine again. And they also had Sadie Miller, who is Elizabeth Sladen's daughter, who's appeared in Big Finish and written for, I think, Candy Jar Books and stuff. They also had Sophie Aldred and Fraser Hines and John Coleshaw. And and Derek Martin as well, the man from Havoc. I guess to kind of spread it out a bit more over the entire weekend. And that looked great fun again. Although I'm not sure what the weather was like.
I was going to say, I feel so saying like something slightly controversial, but I think I'm done with conventions.
Really?
I think I'm bored of them, yeah.
What was the last? You didn't go to the last two.
I feel as though, well, that's one of the reasons why. I just think, you know, I've kind of met everyone I want to meet now, and if magic's died for me a little bit, really.
Yeah, it has become, I don't know if they're going to keep doing it, but it certainly felt to me more like this was more of a normal convention than the actual sort of more demons-related one, which they had at Oldbourne in 2019, which is fine for some people, but I didn't feel the same desire to go that I had last time.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's not really a convention, though, that is it? So much, Hayden. It's more sort of gathering, really, isn't it?
Oh, gatherings are all right. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being really dull and bored by them. I don't know.
Perhaps. I mean, I think you've been to more than I have and done more signings and stuff than I have, so...
I think that's it. I think...
You're old and jaded, Hayden, whereas me and Doc are young and enthusiastic.
It's reversed. Well, I kind of feel like... I feel like, I've met Tom Baker twice. That's more than enough. There's probably someone out there who's never met him who should probably take my place in the queue, if you know what I mean, because they deserve their moment with him.
Mm.
I've already had my moment with him. I mean, fair enough, you know, if it's for the social aspect of it, fine, brilliant, fantastic. But, I mean, if you've got, like, 150 things signed by the same actor or the same writer, I don't know, is that just getting a bit greedy?
Well, I don't know. You have a pretty complete set of Doctor Who signatures, don't you? You have a very impressive set, which you've managed to hunt down and curate over the years.
Mark's got to keep going until he gets Janet, haven't you, Mark?
Well, yeah, exactly. I've got to get that page finished.
Maybe I'm like Jane, the in-betweeners. I've completed it, mate.
Maybe. I mean, I think one of the sad things as well, actually, is that it is getting a bit sort of last chance to see, isn't it? Because
I think, that's a sad... I mean, that, funnily enough, that I was going to say, linking this back into my Web of Fear Blu-ray, it's, you know, the fact that I've got a book there which is signed by Terence Dix and Deborah Watling, and they'll never be... They're sadly not here to sign the Blu-ray or for me to hear what they think of the Blu-ray. You know, it's... You are absolutely correct. And it actually leads me to think, how much longer can you keep doing... keep doing these?
I know that Richard Franklin's had various health troubles, hasn't he? And I know he's also said that the Devil's End gathering would possibly be his last that he attended. Yes. And Katie Manning even said that she thought this would be the last time she'd be going to an Oldbourne convention, which would just leave John Levine. And I don't know how many people wanted to take their young kids along to watch John Levine swearing his head off, which happened when we were there, didn't it, Doc?
Yeah.
Some poor kid with a hearing aid asked if he could stand closer to John Levine. Like, how old must he have been? About 10?
remember.
Something like that. It's all right if I stand near you because I have hearing aid and I can't hear. He's probably, I think, getting too much other background noise and stuff, so he had to stand really close to John Levine. And then John Levine just went off effing and blinding. Effing and jeffing he was for about 10 minutes, which was...
I think I'm growing quite cynical as well about the fact that these things do cost quite a lot of money in recent times. I don't mind the capital, but that's mainly because I know the people who run it and they're very nice people. But this, I had a run-in with one of these fan conventions, the people who set up the fan conventions, when I asked a very innocent question online recently.
Ah, yes, I'm...
And I just kind of feel people like that just don't deserve my money because they do cost quite a lot, these things. It's the travelling there, it's all the rest of it. And like I said, brilliant if I had lots of friends who go to these things an awful lot. But apart from you two and a couple of others, I really don't. I was quite jaded after the BFI thing, if you remember as well. Because it's always the same faces. You go to these things, it's just the same people. And you just think, come on, there's other people who want to, you know, who will kill for a ticket. And then you've got very younger people more nearer my age, and they're very clicky, aren't they?
Yeah.
Or they put stuff online saying, oh, come and see me at this event, but only if you're Benjamin Cook, or if you're Ed Russell, or if you're Colin Baker. Or.
And so, as our status as the official podcast of the Dwast Capital Convention disappears over the horizon, this'll cheer you up, this headline. Northwest England wins more Olympic medals for Team GB than any other region.
Why should that? I'm not from the Northwest. Why should that cheer me up?
I just thought that my happiness would...
would it radiate onto me.
It's true, Doc. Your happiness is infectious.
Yes, maybe I should start thinking about the treble in 1999. It'll make me really happy.
This is a nice sentence. So I do think the first four words are unnecessary. Forget London and Yorkshire. Northwest England is the new home of TGB's Olympics medal factory. Oh no, it's not as happy as I thought it would be. The region secured 19 medals in Japan. This was one fewer than New Zealand. Right. Right, on to the point. Having reviewed Day of the Doctor for our 150th podcast last time, we decided to have a look at An Adventure in Space and Time, which was the film made, which came out the week before, didn't it? Day of the Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was the only thing that I think came out very early on in that year to prove, well, to dispel the rumour that there was nothing going on for the 50th. Because I remember seeing online, friend of the show Kevin Davis went along to Westminster Bridge and watched them film the scene with the Daleks coming over the bridge.
Oh, that's right, yes.
And put that up online. I remember seeing that. And that was as early as January. Because obviously he'd done it for the more than 30 years in the TARDIS. I remember being really excited about this. I mean, that's complete opposite to Mark, who I don't think knew it existed until a few weeks ago. Did you?
That's not true. That isn't true. I knew it existed. I knew it was happening. I had a lot going on at that time, and I missed the broadcast completely. I wasn't even just like quarter of an hour late for the broadcast like I was with the original, with the actual 50th anniversary story. I completely missed it, and I purchased it on DVD couple of years later. I think it was in a sale, and I've never actually got around to watching it. I mean, I have moved several times, so unfortunately a lot of my DVDs get packed up into boxes and stuck in storage, so I would claim that as a sort of excuse.
So when was the first time you ever saw it?
The first time I ever saw it would have been 4 days ago. I know I'm a bad fan.
Now, do you know what? When you were mumbling to yourself then, I just knew you were counting on your fingers. I could hear the arithmetic going on there. 4 days ago. Well, I'm intrigued to see what you made of it. I'm more than intrigued. I'm glued to the edge of my seat, Mark. Because you've only seen it once. That's going to be really interesting.
And I managed to, it seems I managed to avoid some spoilers as well in all that time, which is quite impressive. I mean, I had no idea I was going to be seeing Nick Briggs with hair.
He wasn't on it, was he?
Yes, he was doing the voice of the Daleks.
So, An Adventure in Space and Time, a biographical film made as part of Doctor Who's 50th anniversary celebrations in 2013, focusing on a dramatised version of events surrounding the creation of Doctor Who in the 1960s, premiered on BBC Two on the 21st of November 2013. That would have been Thursday, I imagine, 2 days before the actual anniversary on the 23rd. Produced by Matt Stevens, directed by Terry McDonough. I didn't realise that, from Breaking Bad.
Oh, is that where he's from?
Blimey.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
Watched by 2.71 million viewers in the UK. Doctor Who would kill for those figures these days, wouldn't they?
2.7?
2.71 million.
That surprises me. That's much really lower than I expected.
No, watched by 2.7 viewers. Doctor Who would kill for those ratings these days. Mark, given that you've got the most recent reaction to it,
yeah,
given that our reactions are about 8 years old, would you like to start us off in your thoughts on the show?
Yeah, sure. It was very exciting. I was kept thinking to myself, why haven't I watched this before? Just from I know the opening titles aren't particularly exciting, but the opening titles and the music reminded me a bit of the Doctor Who and the Daleks movies from the Peter Cushing
films. Oh, right, yes.
And yeah, and as soon as it started up, that bit with the just, it's beautiful the way it alluded to the first Doctor Who novelisation. With the car pulling up on
Barnes Common.
Yeah.
Yes.
Police box there. And it was just, I just thought, oh, that's great. And to be honest, that sensation pretty much went on for the entire, 90 minutes of it. It was just, oh, it's just glorious. You know, those opening scenes after the Barnes Common bit. I started getting goosebumps and feeling slightly teary, even just seeing those first shots of William Hartnell's dressing room and seeing his wig and his costume there. And then to actually see the sets and the studio and that beautiful camera shot of him walking out onto the set for the final part of 10th Planet. And it just, oh, man, I was absolutely swept away with it. It's funny because it's one of these things where you know the story, you know the facts. Well, most fans do. We've all read about a dozen books or a dozen reiterations of the birth of Doctor Who, but to actually see it come to life before your eyes. I know it's only a dramatisation, it's not a documentary, but it was thrilling. And seeing William Russell outside the front of the BBC television centre concierge?
No, concierge.
No, what is it? As the commissioner. The commissionaire, seeing William Russell standing outside BBC Television Centre as the commissionaire.
It's some French word, isn't it, to describe old man Stansel most of the day. That's what it is.
You know, absolutely lovely. Absolutely lovely. To be honest, I could probably watch, I'd love to see a series of dramas just set in 1960s BBC Television Centre, I think. It's such, well, I mean, not just set in the 60s, maybe just, oh, I'd love to see dramatisation of the history of BBC Television Centre, because it's a building that I adore it massively. And this was, I believe, the last drama ever filmed there.
Before its closure, yeah.
Yeah, before,
yeah, you're right,
it closed.
Yeah, it was. But don't tell the anti-vaxxers that, because they think it's still open.
Yeah, I was going to say, recently, I guess a lot of our UK listeners will have heard about the anti-vaxxer mob who decided they'd have a protest and try to gain entry to BBC headquarters. So they went to the headquarters that they moved out of
8 years ago.
Yeah, which is just marvellous. Idiots. And it's obviously, I think, as I've said before on here, it's a place I have been fortunate enough to visit. And
yes!
One of the most exciting afternoons out that I've ever had. Yeah, wonderful afternoon. I remember sitting drinking a a crafty vodka and having a cigarette in a little smoking room that we found. Because the place still, back in 1999, they still had smoking rooms for people sat in there having a drink and a fag. I visited BBC Television Centre once, and I remembered that as I was walking through that part.
What were you doing there? Were you appearing on something?
Me and my friend had won tickets to see, it was 1999, we applied for tickets to be in the studio audience for something that Mark Lamar was doing about the end of the millennium. I can't remember what it was, a comedy panel show, and his guest was John Sargent, the news guy.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, me and my friend, we were told to wait in this lobby with a load of other people, and we just got in one of the lifts in BBC TV Centre, went up to a random floor, got out and started walking around. And whenever anybody came towards us, I just started saying to my friend, it's just down this corridor just here, if you'll follow me. Everyone just ignored us. We just walked for about a quarter of an hour round and round the BBC, staring in through windows and stuff. And so, yeah, it's really exciting. It's great.
Having no idea where you're going?
No, absolutely no idea at all. And then eventually we made it back down and got into the TV studio for the filming. If I'd gone on a different day, I might have seen Alice Cooper on there, which would have been incredible. Oh. And people just, nobody gave us a second glance. Yeah, I mean, the anti-vaxxers would have had a field day back in 99, but...
Here we are, we've got the news report. Anti-vaccine protesters storm BBC HQ 8 years after it moved out. Group gain access to old television centre in West London, which is now mostly rented by ITV daytime shows. Confused anti-vaccine protesters stormed what they thought was a major BBC building on Monday, apparently unaware that the corporation largely moved out almost a decade ago. Rather than target the BBC's news operation, which they hold responsible for promoting COVID-9 vaccines, the swines, a handful of protesters gained access to Television Centre, which is now predominantly rented by ITV to film Good Morning Britain and This Morning.
And I believe the rest of it's luxury flats. So, yeah, that's how you sock it to the man.
However, the vast majority of London-based BBC staff and its news operation are based 5 miles away at Broadcasting House.
Brilliant.
The Loose Women co-host Charlene White thanked the security team who kept protesters out of the studio while her ITV programme was on air on Monday afternoon. Not sure what protesters were hoping to achieve, but all they would have found was me, Jane, Nadia and Penny talking about the menopause. Among the individuals outside was Piers Corbyn, brother of the former Labour Party leader, who was recorded on one live stream as saying, "We've got to take over these bastards." Hundreds of people outside the studio building chanted, "Shame on you," with short scuffles breaking out with police officers guarding the entrance to the studios. Police reinforcements and a helicopter were later deployed to the scene.
They even had a bear in the air.
Oh, that's, what a delightful country we now live in.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the country where, was it 2 weekends ago, the anti-vaxxers had a rally in Trafalgar Square where they called for doctors and nurses to be lynched. This is the trash that inhabits our country these days. Having said that, I did have my first ever lateral flow test at home on Friday, which I'm now doing 2 times a week in expectation of moving back to my offices at work. Anyway, back to...
What a tangent.
Back to your reaction to the show, Mark. You're just saying that you loved Television Centre.
Yes. I Television Centre is just one of the many, many things that I loved about it, really. So it's just to have things visualised so beautifully. Beautifully? To have things... visualised so beautifully. You know, the realisations of the sets in the studios, it's just glorious. I thought it's pretty much perfect for me, and I'd also managed to avoid the... I knew that people had said, oh, Matt Smith, blah-de-blah, did something at the end of An Adventure in Space and Time. But I, whenever I people have started talking about it, I've kind of tuned out and gone, oh, I can't hear you, and because I've been hoping to not spoil it for myself. So I wasn't prepared for when, during William Hartnell's kind of mini breakdown towards the end in his final scenes, that he looks across the console and there's Matt Smith smiling back at him. And it's just, it was lovely. And I did have a tear run down my face. It's just wonderful.
What are your memories of it, Hayden?
They're not as clear as I thought, actually. I got a feeling, this went out on a Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
And it was late night, it was 9 o'clock, and I remember they were showing An Unearthly Child on BBC Four straight after it. So it was in this like 90-minute slot, 9 o'clock on BBC Two. And I remember really looking forward to seeing it, but at the same time being a bit worried that it wasn't going to be any good,
yeah,
basically. Because David Bradley, I remember my dad saying he saw him in Profile in the wig, and this must have been in the build-up, I don't know whether he saw an image or thing, and said he looks quite a lot like William Hartnell. Oh, I think it was the moment when he's in the car at the start, actually.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
That was in a trailer, and I think when I saw that, I said, God, he does look like William Hartnell. And I thought, yeah, he does, doesn't he? And it also had Jessica Raine in it, who at the time was the main character in Call the Midwife and had been in Hyde.
Yeah.
Sacha Dhawan I didn't know at that point. But I thought, yeah, this looks quite good. And I thought, yeah, hopefully she'll pull off a really good impersonation of Verity Lambert. With Brian Cox is there as Sidney Newman. So it was a very strong cast. It was a cast that was mostly known to me. And I thought it was such a lovely thing. It was such a brilliant love letter to the show. And it was quite warts and all. It was, you could almost feel the smoke coming through the screen.
Oh, yeah.
From all the cigarette smoke. From the Cyberman smoking by the TARDIS at the beginning, to the bits in the BBC canteen, to Verity smoking while she looks inside the Dalek as it's coming along, trundling along.
Yeah.
To show William Hartnell as being, you know, not dressing this up. He was a cantankerous, bitter man when he went into that role. And the purpose of the show is to show how the magic of Doctor Who made him better. You know, he has a better rapport with his granddaughter when he takes on the role. It shows his descent as well with his illness. I was quite surprised at how well balanced it was with the light and the dark. You know, the moments when the little boys, that was a nice bit as well, when the little boy comes up to him in the park and says, oh, can you sign this please, Doctor Who? And his name's Alan. That was my dad's name.
Oh, right.
And that was also the same, he probably would have been about the same age because my dad remembered watching An Unearthly Child and watching the Daleks and all of the 60s stuff, a lot of the stuff obviously is no longer with us too. And I remember on first viewing, the moment when Matt Smith pops up at the end, really trying to hold back the waterworks and thinking, you soppy old date, you know.
I see, not that you were desperate to use the toilet.
No, I probably was actually after 90 minutes. This is before you could stop and start telly, wasn't it, as easily,
yes,
as you do now.
Yeah.
Oh, such old-fashioned days.
And then seeing that little bit at the end, the, you know, the one day I shall come back. Yes, I shall come back. I thought it was glorious. It was so wonderfully done. And it really, it was interesting because the anchor to the whole thing is Verity Lambert and Waris Hussein. They're really the main characters in this play.
Mm.
But they're gone. Waris Hussein goes after the first third. By the second third, Verity's gone. Then David Bradley holds it together as William Hartnell, showing how all of these changes around him and how much he didn't like them, and, you know, all of his the actors who he started with drifting away. I thought David Bradley was brilliant as William Hartnell, but then again, I'm probably saying that because, barring a very short interview which was found, not, I think it was around the time actually of this.
Yes,
of him being cranky and being a bit cross too.
Is that in the dressing room?
In the dressing room,
the pantomime,
it, yeah,
that he went on to perform,
yeah,
afterwards. Yeah,
yeah, that's it. And that, I suppose we've only really got that to base it off. But I thought he was fantastic as Hartnell. And yeah, I mean the design of it and the way they recreated these things was magnificent. Not so much the companions,
no,
especially after the initial three.
No, not so much Patrick Troughton either, really.
Well, that was my issue with it, because when I got the DVD and when I saw certain things popping up on Twitter that Mark Gatiss couldn't resist but to dress up as Pertwee and get his mate in as Reese Shearsmith, you do kind of think, oh, that's a bit... Do you know what we were saying in the last episode, Doc, about getting Doctor Who out of the biscuit circle, as it were?
Yeah,
this is the reason why, because that kind of spoilt it a little bit for me, seeing the behind the scenes. It's just unnecessary.
Yeah, and they even went on to recreate the Three Doctors pictures, didn't they? That's, I guess, it was the excuse that Mark Gatiss had for dressing up as John Pertwee, wasn't it? Like, oh, we're going to recreate the Three Doctors pictures and then not use them.
And then they did the regeneration as well, which was a thing on the DVD extras, which was him regenerating into Troughton, then regenerating into Pertwee. And I just thought, what's the point in that? And that was a bit sort of fan wanky.
Oh dear.
Too much past the fan wank that we wanted and craved from this. I just thought, that's just a bit unnecessary. Which is a shame, because actually I think this is probably Mark Gatiss's best work. I know that he'd done those hit and miss comedy sketches for Doctor Who Night back in 2000, I think.
99, I think.
99, right. Yeah. And, bits of them were funny, bits of them weren't.
Yeah, but you've got a problem because they featured David Walliams, haven't you?
Well, I've got... No, it's... Yeah, okay, that's a bit of a problem. But, oddly enough, I was watching those links last week because they came up on YouTube. And I actually think the funniest one now is the one I never really liked much, and that was the kidnapping Peter Davison one.
Yeah.
Which I think it's pretty funny.
Oh, I like the Pitch of Fear. I find that highly amusing. As a kind of a fannish piss take of Doctor Who, I think it's rather beautifully done.
What, the for the first 18 years, we need gentlemen's clothes, frock coats, all the rest of it. Oh, what about the rest of it? Oh, anything goes, really. Jumpers, cricket whites.
Yeah, the very best actors of their time will be in the role until the last.
Yeah, until towards the end it'll be any f***er with an equity card.
Yes.
And that's the reason why Colin Baker still doesn't talk to Mark Gatiss, apparently, 20 years on.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
because
wow.
He was very hurt by that comment. But yeah, actually, I think it's fantastic. I think it's really, really good. Does what it needs to do. Like I said, Gatiss balances the lighter and the darker elements of that time. I think the cameos are nice as well, like the people who they've invited back and where they've put them. Does anyone spot Carol Ann Ford as the mother calling her children in to watch the Daleks?
Oh, no, I didn't spot that. I spotted Annika Wills and Jean Marsh at the party, and obviously I spotted William Russell.
Well, they almost had signs over their heads, didn't they, with arrows saying...
Yeah.
Old stars. But I preferred Carolyn Ford's, actually, because you... But it's a bit too obvious with the other two, I think, isn't it? Particularly Jean Marsh. Mm. I really enjoyed it.
Hooray!
I think it has one or two faults, but I can enjoy it as just the story without worrying about those. Whereas I can also watch it and think, oh, well, I'm not sure that quite works very well. I mean, clearly they have to, bearing in mind that there's a limit to how long it can be, and that it's got to also appeal to a non-fan audience. They've got, I think they sort of collapse, don't they? David Whittaker in with Mervyn Pinfield.
Yes. Yeah, it's like a composite character, isn't he, Mervyn Pinfield in this?
And Donald Wilson is also excluded, isn't he? But I don't mind that too much. I think the best thing about it is how it's been shot. I adore everything about what they've done with Television Centre. Probably not the smartest thing to do after they've just quit the place to show how absolutely beautiful it is. Well, some of those shots... looking upwards through the donut at the moon. And when they're on the on the balcony on the top floor hugging each other. Absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And some of the design, I mean, the effort they must have gone to recreate the original TARDIS. even to the point of making the console green, as it would have had to been to appear bright white in black and white. I mean, Uncle Terence, what do you think the optimum colour for a TARDIS console is?
It's green! Thanks, Uncle Terence. Checks in the post, yeah?
And the recreation of the Marco Polo set. Because I think you assume, don't you? Oh, it's only black and white, so they probably won't bother painting it properly. But if you look at some of the telesnaps and promotional photos of it, it was gorgeous reds and blues and deep greens, wasn't it?
Oh, I was going to say, and Vortis and the Monoptera as well was what another brilliant recreation.
And I love Sydney's office on the sixth floor thing, although I have heard someone say, I don't remember executive offices being that luxurious at the television centre.
He did have a nice pedestal ashtray, though, Doc, I saw. We do enjoy pedestal ashtray, don't we?
How did we get onto that? Is that something to do with Jodie's unveiling? When they had that that stone with
the ashtray.
Yes, that was right, yes. Yeah. I think one of the great strengths in it is Brian Cox, who carries it along a lot. Admittedly, you don't know whether Sidney Newman really was as flamboyant as that. But then Brian Cox is the best of most things he's in. When he was in the original series of Sharp, he was often the best thing in it. The way that Bill is all insecure on set, and very to see Sydney walking past, so she grabs him and brings him in. He just turns on the charm like a light switch and says, what an amazing actor you are. This is going to be huge, Doctor Who. And then as Bill walks away, he takes Verity aside, he switches off the charm. He says, so you can be a director, then get it right, or,
Sydney! Sydney Newman, head of drama. Let me introduce you to Mr. William Hartnell.
Right! Our doctor! Great choice. I'm a big fan. Big fan.
Oh, thank you. But I do need to discuss...
What was that terrific war picture you were in? What was that?
Well, I've done a few, The Way Ahead.
Yeah! Hell of a picture! You were sensational!
Oh, do you really think so?
Oh, yes, absolutely extraordinary.
Well, I did get some very nice notices, yes.
Oh, was that before or after Brighton Rock?
Oh, before.
Of course! You were in Brighton Rock! Wow, what a performance!
Oh, well, you're very kind. It should have led to much bigger and better things, you know, but I wasn't blessed.
Not blessed? What the hell are you talking about? Of course you're blessed. You're going to be Doctor Who, aren't you?
Well.
You, sir, are going to make a huge impact with this character.
I am?
Only a movie star could do it. So nuanced. So many layers.
Well, you know, one tries.
And these kids are perfect for it. You couldn't be in safer hands. Fun, energy, youth. Pop, pop, pop.
Freaks.
Thank you so much, Sydney. You've no idea what a difference it makes.
Be a producer, Verity. Find a way to deal with this stuff. Or are you out of your depth?
And one of my favourite scenes is where she turns up in his office thinking she's going to get hauled over the coals. And he reveals what an enormous audience figures they've got for the show.
10 million viewers for your bug-eyed monsters. 10 million. So, what do I know about it? Well done, kid.
But I do have problems with the portrayal of Verity. I think Jessica Raine from Call the Midwife is a very good performance, is a very engaging character. But I'm not sure how much of a believable Verity Lambert she is.
Yeah, I suppose.
She's much more midwife than the producer in this.
Well, she keeps asking Bill to push.
She was very much, oh, this will be great, and oh dear, I'm really under pressure. but little sense of, not much sense of what we were being told, famously, that she was full of piss and vinegar. I just think she isn't sufficiently pissy or vinegary. Yeah, you've got the point where she sits in front of Peter Bratsky and refuses to move until he cooperates. And yes, she does stand up to Sydney and say, can we reshoot it?
No. No, doesn't Sydney make them reshoot it?
Yeah, he makes them do that.
Yeah, you're right, so yeah.
No, she stands up to him about the Daleks.
She stands up and says, I want it broadcast again. Because the first night was interrupted by the death of Kennedy, wasn't it, the previous night? And so she says, right, well, I want us to rebroadcast the first episode before the second one, on the second weekend. But really, the only real example of her standing up for, of her, oh, here's a woman who doesn't stand for any nonsense, is when she sticks up for Warrior Sussain in the BBC bar. And even then they have to turn Toby Haydock into a racist to make it happen. And so I didn't really get the impression of particularly what Sydney saw in her. A really engaging character, and you're really, you know, you're rooting for her to succeed. But I don't think you really see why she
got there in the first place.
Why she got there in the first place, or what she achieved. Because she wasn't just effectively a nobody before Doctor Who, was she? She had achieved a lot. Admittedly, she hadn't been able to get there as a producer.
I think you're right. I think there's an awful lot. I seem to remember that there's a moment in this where she says, "I told myself, give myself a year in television or get out."
Yes.
And she thinks that she's going to be another assistant to him.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe she was that ambitious that she thought, right, well, now I'm going to become a producer and I'm going to give it a year, and if it doesn't happen in a year, then it's not going to happen and I'm off. But I think what you mean by her being quite midwife-like in this is that she's quite softly.
Yeah.
Where she maybe could have been a bit more brash, perhaps, in getting that across. Yeah. I like the, in contrast, I quite like the frantic nature of Warrior Sussain in this. And I know that Sacha Dhawan had studied him quite closely and met with, and I think this happened with the actress who portrayed Carol Ann Ford as well, where they actually met their contemporaries.
Yes, and that's what they know, Sasha met Warris, yeah.
Yes, yeah, to get the speech, to get their patterns, to get their tics, and to get their mannerisms right, you know. And I suppose for someone like Jessica Raine, she would have had stuff like, I think Kevin Davis gave them unused interview outtakes, like the rushes of stuff like More Than 30 Years and stuff, where a bit more of her personality comes through before they say and action.
Oh,
you know, because you're always
right.
Rolling before they say action. Because he actually, they showed this at Riverside Studios in the cinema not long after, and I went along to that to watch it. And Kevin's rushes were shown before that to show a bit more, because it was a celebration of Verity Lambert's life, and that was when they unveiled the plaque for her there.
What, him interviewing Verity?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that stuff on 30 Years in the TARDIS?
Only the interviews.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, not the bits before it, like, alright, where's my eye line? Where do you want me to look? And this, you know, it was those kind of bits that he showed before this to show a bit more of the woman herself, which is what...
Because if you think about it, you think, oh, Barry Letts and Terrence and J&T and that, you think of them, you immediately know what they look like, the sort of tics and mannerisms of their being interviewed, the sound of their voice. Well, I don't think you do with Verity, do you? Because she left fairly early on. Unless you... I'm sure there are interviews out there.
Because she's
not plastered all over whole, you know, eras of the DVD extras. You don't really know what to compare her with.
Yeah, that's true.
I did like the couple playing Ian and Barbara. But I do agree that from then on, the companions were just... they were just figures turning up for a photo shoot, weren't they?
No, they weren't even lookalikes, were they? No. They weren't even really trying. Like Peter Purvis's Stephen Taylor looked like just someone had basically shrunk him. Whilst Polly, the woman who portrayed Polly, was a lot I know Annika Wills wasn't very happy with her.
Didn't we bring that up when we interviewed Annika at Capitol?
Yes.
And we asked her what she thought of her double. And did she say something like, well, I don't remember being a foot taller than Mike yeah. Grace.
And, well, that was based on the Twice Upon a Time, though, wasn't it?
Oh, right. Yeah, and I'm not sure. Now, of course, the doctors were quite blasé about the fact they have 13 odd regenerations, but you've actually regenerated three times, haven't you? Once into your adventuring space and time, shall we say, incarnation.
Yes.
Once into your animated incarnation for Power of the Daleks, and once into your... Oh, what was it? I forgot what... Twice Upon a Time incarnation for Christmas.
Twice Upon a Time.
What order would you put them in order of how much they were like your Polly?
None of them. None of them had the magic that was me. You know, Adventures in Time and Space, the poor girl had her hair curled. You know, like luscious curls that the girls wear now. But, you know, the wardrobe, you only had to take a photograph and have a look. Why did they have to... And she had a Wonder Bra. And Polly was obviously, you know, my measurements were sort of 32, 22, 32. You know, I was a willow, you know.
Classic 60s.
It was so obvious. And so if you're recreating a character... I mean, they got David Bradley absolutely right. They got Patrick Troughton hopelessly wrong.
Yeah.
And me hopelessly wrong. And then at Christmas, poor Lily Travers, I was really looking forward to her playing Polly. And there she is, poor thing, in a pink sort of, it looked like a woolly blanket that they'd cut up and made into a dress. I had a lovely, smooth, you know, little 60s dressy, bright red with forest green detail, very tasty, little belt, very nice. And then she had a Thunderbird's wig. What, you know, but you only have to look at the photographs to see what the hair is like. Why do they reinterpret it? That's my big question.
Also, Ben looked terrible in Twice Upon a Time in that.
Twice Upon a Time, hopeless.
Strange haircut he had.
And much too tall, bless him. Much too tall. Yeah. And in the Christmas special, just hopelessly not like Mike at all. No lovely cockney cheeky chappy. Come on, doctor! You know, shake a leg kind of thing. No, you know, let's have ya.
But you are absolutely right. They don't look anything like the people that they're supposed to be playing.
Yes, you are right, actually. Yes, it was based on Twice Upon a Time.
The chap who plays... Peter Purvis, well, I suppose, looks like he could be a CBeebies presenter, which I guess, in a way, Peter Purvis kind of was for a while.
And that's my problem with Reece Shearsmith. He might as well just be one of the companions turning up for that photo shoot, you know, in front of the fountain, in the middle of the TVC donut, because he... Computer, can you put up a photograph, please, of the second Three Doctors trio?
Cosplaying, isn't it?
I mean, Bill Hartnell looks even more like him next to those two, doesn't he? And if you sort of defocus your eyes slightly, you could possibly imagine Mark Gatiss as John. But who came up with the idea of Reece? It must have been because they're mates, wasn't it?
I also felt that Reece Shearsmith sort of seemed to portray Patrick Troughton slightly as a kind of Ken Dodd-like character. It's...
Yes. He seemed to portray him as the second Doctor rather than as Patrick Troughton, the actor, didn't he?
Well, apparently Troughton, when the way that they did the regeneration was they lay down together and they put their feet against, like, the soles of their feet against one another, so they're just like they're lying out in one long line, and the camera just panned from Hartnell's face to Troughton's face, and they locked it off on either side and then mixed it, and apparently Troughton just looked up at Hartnell and said, "Hello, Dad."
Where where did you get this
so
from?
So he was joking around a little bit. It's on the second time round.
No, sorry, the Life of Brian thing.
Oh, that's been doing the rounds on Twitter today. I love it. That. I think it's brilliant.
Yes.
That's so good. Anyway, I think for me, it ticked all the boxes of what it needed to do. And I think the only things that do... I didn't like the fact that this obsession with this David Tennant I don't want to go line.
Mm.
It's just pathetic. It's utterly pathetic. It's like, yeah, okay, have Hartnell break down and cry, but why do they have to then... I didn't like that. I didn't like that moment. Because it took me out of me out of it. Why is it referencing something that, you know, happens 50 years in the future nearly?
It totally took me out because obviously we've only just done the Day of the Doctor and been complaining about the line being used in that. So it was still very fresh in my mind and it broke the moment really, didn't it?
And I didn't like the Shearsmith bit because I just thought, well, and also because I was a League of Gentlemen fan as a teenager. It's just sort of getting his mate in to do this little part, but it's not a little part. It's actually quite a big part because it's the person who's taking over. I really honestly do not know why they didn't just get Michael Troughton in to do that bit. Because I remember seeing him around this time. It was, actually it would have been several months after this, but at the Prince Charles Cinema, they showed Enemy and Webb back to back. And Michael Troughton was a guest of honour. He sat up on stage and I thought, God, he looks so much like his dad. He had the hair as well, just like, you know, slightly greying but long wavy hair. And I just thought, oh, they could have just got him in. Because also Rhys Shearsmith's tiny and very slight. And Troughton was, he was quite small, but he had, you know, a bit on him. He wasn't like a, you know, a little beanpole, was he? Certainly not by the time he was in Doctor Who. He was when he was in Robin Hood, but not when he was Doctor Who. You know, as a middle-aged man. You know, Rhys Shearsmith looked far too young.
But I think that shows what I've said a few times. I think that Gittes cast him because they were together in League of Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Not because, and possibly because he's a Doctor, Shearsmith's a Doctor Who fan. Not because he thought he'd be good in the role.
No, absolutely not.
And you wonder, yes, he's an actor, but not appropriate. You wonder to what extent people have been given writing jobs, for instance, in Doctor Who, because, oh, wouldn't it be great, because so-and-so, we know he's a big Doctor Who fan. Are they the right person to write this story?
I think for the basis of what this is trying to do, absolutely on this occasion, it has to be a big fan and has to be someone who knows how to make telly and how to write for it as well. So, yeah, by all means, I think Mark Gatiss was a very good pick to write this.
Oh, don't mean Mark. I have no problem with Mark Gatiss. I'm talking about Rhys Shearsmith.
Well, yeah, but this is the other... I mean, you know, Jessica Raine is in it because she was in Hyde. Nicholas Briggs is in it because he does the Dalek voices and is a mate of Gatiss's. You know, it's nepotism. Yeah. Not nepotism within an actual family, but it's nepotism within the Doctor Who family that so many people pop up. I mean, yeah, fair enough. You know, get Carol Ann Ford and Annika Wills and, you know, those guys to come back and do a little, you know, little second on screen.
Mm.
But yeah, the Rhys Shearsmith one... That and the I don't want to go line pulled me out of it completely.
They're probably thinking, well, we can get away with it doing Rhys Shearsmith because he's only on for, say, half a minute. Which I don't think they should say things like that. Either you go for excellence or you don't. You just do it because you're getting a job for your mates.
No. But I think otherwise, I think this was a fantastic love letter to the show.
Yes, I do.
And it left me with a very warm feeling and quite upset at the end, actually. I mean, to see Hartnell's demise is quite upsetting.
It's terribly upsetting, that. Not so much for me, the bit at the end, as more the whole going through it, how...
The deterioration.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did like the bit in the park where... did you notice when the little boy asks for his autograph, before he turns round, David Bradley... stubs out his cigarette.
Yes.
You know, this idea that I think you only hear it from Tom, don't you, that he would...
Yeah.
He wouldn't be seen smoking or drinking or even eating sometimes when there were children around.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to put out... And I thought that was a nice little bit.
I think the look and the design of it as a period
gorgeous.
Piece is fantastic.
Mm.
And the recreation of the sets is absolutely wonderful. Really, really good. And you're right, it is that attention to detail, but it's the linking. I suppose things like that I don't mind, you know, because I noticed that and I thought, oh, yeah, that's something Tom Baker said once, was, you know, he didn't smoke in front of children. So I enjoyed that part. But I think to single out one line and one cameo that's on screen for 10 seconds is really just trying to pick holes in it because of how good it is and how nice it is.
But to be fair, it is an outrageously bad cameo.
Well, that's it. Well, exactly. And it was the main grumble at the time, I seem to remember.
Now, something I don't think you've ever revealed to us, Hayden. When Verity realises that her bug-eyed monsters suddenly have got this huge audience, you see those little schoolboys shouting exterminate on the upper deck of the bus. I'm sure that Mark and I, in school playgrounds, went around saying exterminate with our arms out in front of us. Did you ever do that?
There's a bit in my book, Child Out of Time, growing up with Doctor Who in the wilderness years, available from good bookstores, when I mentioned that the older boys at school, when I was in reception and year one, so I was about 4 or 5, were going around with the baskets on their heads that we had, like that contained like tennis balls and stuff, and they would go around with their arms outstretched because they would have been 5, 6, 7 years older than me, which would have meant they would have been my age when the McCoy stuff was going out.
Oh my God, I've just had a memory which has just suddenly come back into my mind, which has been buried for ages.
We went to school together.
No, it's not entirely connected to an adventure in space and time, but I just remembered after watching Pyramids of Mars, I remember in the playground in Tonaruin Primary School in Cardiff.
Sitting on someone's
hand. Walking around pretending to be mummies and trying to catch people and crush them.
Oh!
Did you have a three-way hug with one of your teachers?
Well, it was the 70s.
Aren't they violent in Wales?
Oh, dear. But yeah, so they did, and we did. But by the time that I was really getting into it, which was the late 90s, it was something that popped up every now and then if BBC Two had a repeat or you had the Curse of Fatal Death on Comic Relief and stuff. Otherwise, it wasn't really anything that... But people knew what the Daleks were because they did pop up on TV, and I think the Radio Times had one on front cover once as well as a kid. So,
yeah, I loved the Dalek scenes in this as well. Again, that's another brilliant set. And the whole thing about when they're sort of being wheeled into Television Centre, into the studio, and the way people are looking at them.
Yes, I like that.
And it's just, and that piece of music as well that is playing along, that has kind of the Dalek, a bit of the Dalek heartbeat kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
That was just, that was another, it's like made the hair on my arm stand up.
The recreated set of Skaro from that, they then moved to the Doctor Who Experience, and I've got pictures of me on that set. Because, of course, they had the console as well. And yes, annual with David Bradley's face on it.
I do remember seeing that TARDIS console at the Experience in Cardiff. I enjoyed the parallels between the Daleks and the BBC executives when you just see one of the executives saying, "Kill Doctor Who."
Oh, yes.
Is it Verity and Warris saying about the executives, saying that, you know, they hate anyone not like themselves? And so I love those parallels between the Daleks trying to exterminate the Doctor and hating anyone not like themselves, and the BBC executives at the time.
Yeah.
So that's quite clever.
I did say the thing about where Sydney eventually says, right, just reshoot the first episode. I never really thought much about that. I thought, oh, well, maybe they just did it because it must have been that bad. I mean, I must admit, I don't recall having watched the DVD extra, the original bad version of it. I don't recall the TARDIS toys behaving that badly. But it made me think while I was watching this, actually, that must have been a big decision for him in the sense of what it might have cost him in political capital at the BBC to reshoot that. And not only how vital it was for the show, but how, if it had gone wrong, how that could have put a spanner in his career. Do you put Spaniards in careers?
Yeah.
And of course, the other big thing about this show, isn't it? They've done it as partly as being a story about how women and minorities within the TV industry began progressing in the 1960s. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff in it where instead of the men insulting Verity for being a woman, I know at one point they call her dear lady, don't they? But that's about as far as they go. Although you do hear someone say, who does she sleep with to get the job? They show it most powerfully, I think, by not insulting them, but ignoring them. Like the barman's ignoring Waris, and how they, when Verity first comes in and they're going through those, what do you call them, those photos they're going through of actors.
Mugshots.
Going through those mugshots of all the actors who they're going to get to play it. And she'll say something, and they'll just carry on talking to each other, ignoring her. I thought that was very powerful. Obviously, it's a way that people used to do things like that. So really, my attitude towards Adventure in Space and Time is that I can thoroughly enjoy it just watching it. Because I can really switch off without from thinking, wouldn't Verity have been a bit more ballsy than that? And just enjoy it for what it is. And I think it's, like you say, it is. I think it probably is the best thing that Mark Gatiss has done. Not in the sense of saying, because everything else is rubbish. Just it is.
Yeah.
It is.
It's top tier, isn't it? It's great. I mean, I think they've been very sensitive. I don't think with a programme like this, people needed to be fully versed in William Hartnell's, what should we say,
social issues.
Yes, social issues. This wasn't the time or place for that. I think because this was a drama as well, and as Hayden said, a love letter to the show, this just wasn't the time or place. I think it's alluded to slightly, and obviously you seem being incredibly bad-tempered with people.
I thought that was more shocking than the fact that he's being rude to me, was saying, don't call me Bill, it's Mr. Hartnell to you, son. Because you're imagining what the set hands and the props people must have been thinking.
Yeah.
They must think, oh God, this sad, arrogant man, because he's got this cheesy kids show. It was mainly restricted, wasn't it, to, he's in the Chinese restaurant, he says chop chop to the waiter, and then he says that lie, which I'm a little guilty for laughing at when Waris is leaving. He says, they're giving me a passage to India, and he says, oh, one way. but they actually have him saying that with a twinkle in his eye to him, doesn't he? As if, he's... talking about the Chinese restaurant, I could have done without the scene where there's one thing I can't stand in films or TV shows, people eating, generally eating at all, especially eating while they're delivering lines. And you've got... You've got Sydney delivering his lines while he's crunching down on prawn crackers. And it sets my teeth on edge. Right. So, is there anything else that anyone's got in the notes?
I've only got music by Edmund Butt because I did like the music a lot.
Yes.
I thought the music on this was excellent. The music by Edmund Butt, I believe. I thought it was very sensitively done. It wasn't overpowering. It was gently emotional, you know, like a gentle wave that you kind of floated along with, rather than big tidal waves that you sometimes get with better-known Doctor Who composers.
I can't think who you mean.
No.
You're telling me that music right now is telling me to feel emotional about this.
Yeah. So that was one thing I had. I think that's about it, really. I think the last thing I've got to say, probably I'd say when I'm doing the score...
But it's interesting that people were saying, weren't they? Because I remember thinking myself, oh, it's 50th anniversary, they're not doing much, are they? Yeah, they've got this story that's coming, Day of the Doctor, but what else are they doing? And then I think everyone forgets, don't they, the other mini-sode they did. But then you've got Night of the Doctor, and you forget that they've done this whole thing, which, if you look at some of the sets and the shooting on this, I think must have cost a fortune to do this. And, of course, you've got, which none of us would have known, and thank goodness we didn't know, in the month before, they suddenly reveal that they've found two whole stories except for one episode.
Yeah, glorious.
And the Five-ish Doctors.
And the Five-ish Doctors rebooted, of course, yeah.
Never heard of it.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
So, marks out of 10?
I think it's a 9.
I'm going to give it a 9.5.
Yeah, I just want to finally say, it's just, like I say, this is a story we all know, or most Doctor Who fans will know and will have read many times, but it is just so thrilling to see it realised in front of your own eyes, and it's, yeah, wonderful. I'll give it 9.5 as well.
Isn't it interesting that if Peter Baratzky had only had a pedestal ashtray to hand, the TARDIS console could have been three-sided forever.
It's true, isn't it?
Right, have we anything else to say? No, but generally, a lovely thing. And I can't believe you went 8 years without watching it, Mark.
No, neither can I, and I just want to apologise to everyone.
We'll include it in the press release, Mark, it's all good.
Mind you, I have to say, in a way, it's kind of been nice not having seen it before, because...
Oh, yes!
I'm not going to... I'm not going to bang on about anything, but it's not been a great time lately. Not just personally, I just mean like globally as well.
Yeah.
And I just think to suddenly have this jolt of joy.
Yeah.
It's been okay for the Northwest, Mark.
Undiluted. Shut up. Undiluted. And for the first time, it's made me glad that I haven't watched it in those last 8 years.
Do you ever have things that you love? Either a book or a TV show or a film or something that you wish, oh, would it be great if I could watch this for the first time again? Well, Mark's shown us how to do it.
Yeah.
Just don't watch it the first time.
Yeah.
He is the trailblazer that we will all follow now.
Delayed gratification.
That should be the name of the podcast.
Yes.
I like that.
Do you know what? After after we finished the last podcast on a slight downturn, yeah. Which is what inspired us to pick An Adventure in Space and Time for this one, I think it's done the job.
Yeah.
Hooray!
Wonderful.
Any thoughts about it next time? I do want to do a Who's Zoom episode, actually, sometimes. I want to bring my... along.
Have we not done those?
Let's do that, then.
So have we got any ideas for... Well, have a think.
We need to fit in McGann's stuff before we do the 10th Doctor, don't we? Because technically brought him out of the bag, didn't we?
Oh, did we? Oh, right.
The 8th Doctor, yeah. But yeah, I reckon do another Whozium.
Let's do Whozium on next time. So have a think about what you want to do, faithful listeners. You two, I mean. And then if we've finished... Oh, Uncle Terence.
Yes, Doc?
Given what we've just been saying about the vileness of the anti-vaxxers, do you have any health advice for us?
Yes, it's don't dump bodies into the river.
Uncle Terence, we have anti-vaxxers in Trafalgar Square.
It's a trap.
Oi!
Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. On iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum. On Twitter at diddly_dum. Or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddlydum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.